With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome back to a very special episode of Ironcast. In this episode, we're looking back on some of our favourite moments from 2023. And what a year it's been, Ginge. I'm going to say, in a calendar year, this has been my best time as a West Ham fan, doing the podcast with you, but also that magnificent night in Prague.
I know.
Lifting the trophy. How has 2023 been for you?
Good, because amazing, because I am now obviously a West Ham fan, obviously being an ex-player, and you know, to win the Conference League was huge for this club, obviously being out there, and then obviously topping it off with doing the podcast with you, mate. So yeah, incredible time to be a West Ham fan.
And we've had so many great guests this year. I'm not going to ask you to pick a favourite.
I thought you were going to for a
second. But what I will say is, for 2024, who you got your eye on? Who are we tapping up next year? Nobes has got to be on.
Nobes has got to be on. Yeah, well, I'll give him a little shout, get Nobes on. I'd love to have Danny Gabardon on. Obviously, my mate, a few stories from obviously coming to the club together. We could do a little special with Gabs. You know, such a, in my eyes, an underrated player for West Ham. And obviously, he's my best mate. So, yeah, there's a lot to come. And a lot of names that we could get on, I think.
Yeah, that's our New Year's resolution sorted on Ironcast. Gabs and Nobes. So much to look forward to in 2024. But right now, let's look back at 2023 with some memories of that famous night in Prague when we claimed European glory. Here's first team coach Kevin Nolan sharing his stories from that wonderful night. We left West Ham as a player in 2015, come back in 2020, and we've just experienced one of the highlights of my entire life supporting West Ham, that magnificent night in Prague. How did the celebrations compare, 2012, 2023?
Oh, wicked. Absolutely brilliant, because we were together. The team was together afterwards, you know, and it was really good. And we went back to the hotel with all our families there, friends. So we were all there. We had a bit of food, drinks, everything, you know, all the singing and all that type of stuff. And then we headed back to our hotel, where it ended up being just me, Knowles and Dech, which was quite a nice moment.
And the trophy?
If you like. No. We weren't interested in the trophy at that point.
We'd won it, hadn't we? So.
And look, it was just nice. Obviously, three captains, you know, just sitting there, sort of chewing the fat, talking about everything, remembering all the good things.
I know we're talking about after the game. Yeah. What are you, do you remember the game? I know you're unbelievable at remembering stats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember all the parts of the game?
I remember when we, obviously they scored, and everyone, everyone was like, as if we'd gone 1-0 down 2-0 down and it'd gone from us. And I was like, hang on a minute.
Yeah,
let's, you know, let's sort of refocus, and we were quite calm on the bench and everything else, and sort of try to get that across to the lad, like, you know, relax, we've got this, you know. And when you're looking for moments of, you know, genius and someone to just play that proper pass, and then obviously the one who you want on the end of it is a Jared Bowen, and I remember as soon as he's played the ball, and then Jared scores, someone shouted offside, and the gaffer always comes and looks at me and goes offside, and I go, no way.
No chance.
I've gone right away, no chance. And I've gone, am I going to be wrong here? And like, you know, in that little dread, and then I've like, because in the conference, it's not as like in the Prem where you get the repeat right away, you're waiting, and I'm like that. So I'm thinking,
Don't get this wrong.
The gaffer was off. I was a little bit concerned that you couldn't keep up with the gaffer, to be honest.
Did he wait for you to say yes before he celebrated?
He was like, nobody's come back and he's given and he's going, it's onside, isn't it? It's onside, definitely.
And I'm thinking, no.
Yeah.
I can't thinking, oh, Gaffer's just done a sprint for like 50 yards, comes back and is offside. Imagine that.
Both armies, isn't it? But yeah, so like just them moments, and it sort of just went back to the playoff final because it was like last minute scoring that goal, and it's just like, now see it out, you know what I mean?
I've said it on here. I think the first one we did, speaking to Gerard about it, we don't do that. West Ham don't score last minute goals and win games and hang on. And the extra time seemed like, I was in the stand that night. It just seemed like it went on forever. But I remember turning to all the West Ham fans in the crowd going, I think I was more shocked we scored a last minute goal because I certainly never happened when I was playing, as in scoring in such a big game and all that. And just
the relief and the feeling in the stand. God knows how you guys felt down on the pitch, but it's the first proper game I'd been to in the stand, like big game supporting West Ham. And it was just unreal night.
Yeah, we've had so many amazing European nights. We're about to hit our third season in a row European football, not just the final, the semis we've been through. How have you found those European nights? Are there any moments stick out for you?
The night in Frankfurt was fantastic, you know, just that experience of them and what they were. Obviously, we were disappointed because we felt that we had an opportunity that year, you know, and we weren't going to let it go again last year, you know, because we thought we were better than Eintracht Frankfurt, and we let ourselves down a bit, I think. And I think we wanted to learn from that. And we go into every game. You know, I certainly believe that we can beat anyone on our day, whether it be in the Premier League or across Europe. And we wanted to keep giving the lads the belief. And it was different last year because we brought in a lot of European players. So it sort of changed, you know, because we had a lot of British-based players who'd sort of left the building. And a lot of European lads who hadn't experienced Premier League football, but had done the European side and, you know, played in them games. So it felt like when we were coming to them games, that felt like that was easy, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it was trying to get them lads to get adjusted to them playing in a Premier League intensity, you know, the athleticism you got to show to go against the Premier League. Because I think like physicality and all that type of stuff, it is, you know, up here compared to the rest of Europe and what's expected each week in, week out after that Thursday game. So it was a big adjustment for a lot of them lads, and I think that's why you're seeing probably the best of them coming into the end of the season and them sort of adjusting to what was it, you know, a tough season for us in the Prem. And we're hoping now that they've adjusted, we're going to be able to now keep building and get better for the Premier League as well as be able to, you know, establish ourselves across Europe again, because I mean, I'm certainly thinking that, you know, we want to get back to the latter stages again. We've got to be a club who gets to the latter stages, and we're serious with the quality we have in the squad. You know, we've obviously lost Dech, but if we can bring the additions in what we're looking at, and I feel that we can sort of dream and, you know, look forward to that and really believe that we can do it.
Oh man, just brilliant to hear that insight from Super Kevin Nolan on that magical night in Prague. But now, let's wind the clock back to the 1980s with cult hero Mark Ward. He reveals what rooming with Julian Dix was like, and let me tell you, it's not for the faint-hearted. Here's Wardy. Julian Dix joined the club in 88.
Yeah.
What was he? I imagine the two of you got on.
He just kicked everyone in training, so... Ruthless, I mean, going over the top and everything. So, and obviously, I was up.
Really, against, he was doing that even to his own.
Yeah,
his
teammates. Proper bully like. So, we were up in a training session, and so I'm right side, and he was left side. So, there's always going to be problems, wasn't there? Anyway, he does me, and then we end up fighting. So, John sends Julian in. I'm on the side. He said, "I'll see you in my office after training." So, it's like the headmaster, wasn't he? So we. But outside, and I'm just looking at him, and he's looking at me, and there's animosity, you know what I mean? Because I couldn't have my own players, you know, trying to injure. And this is what he was like. He was like, I always thought they had a screw loose, you know what I mean? He was naughty. And we spoke about this. So anyway, we get into John's office. He said, "I've got a problem here." He said, "Two of my best players, someone's leg's going to be broken." And Julian went, as he would, "Well, it's not going to be mine." And I went, go just at looked it at again him like in that. I've had a good think about this. He said, from now on, you're rooming together.
Oh,
did he?
That's
it's genius.
That was, yeah, I've heard
he said, yeah. And he said, and you've got to be on the same side in training.
That's
to protect.
Sensible.
And yeah. In the back of my mind, I wasn't scared of him, but I was thinking, well, it's.
Well, you ain't going to pull out of a tackle. You no, ain't going to pull
exactly,
out.
Exactly, yeah.
Going to happen, isn't it?
But James, some of the tackles, man, yeah. It was just like, you know what I mean? So.
Was he quite. Sorry to interrupt you. Was he quite quiet, Dixie?
Julian.
The, like when he wasn't training and
yeah,
that?
Yeah, very. Yeah. Honest to God.
Because he came like, in with Slav, obviously, didn't he, as coach? And Benny, I used to know him as a player. And like you say, I knew he was ferocious, to say the least. But I find it like he was quite chilled. I don't know if that came with age. He was very chilled off the pitch.
Yeah, very, you know, humble in loads of ways. You know what I mean? He was like, so I ended up having to room with him. Now, the first couple of, well, I always remember the first one. We didn't stay in the best hotels, so the two single beds there. And I always remember like the little wire, you know, the remote control on. Like, so I get on my bed and he's on his, and he just goes and snaps it off the wall. So he snaps it. So we can't use the remote control now. So I went, that's all right, isn't it? I said, we've got to get up now to, you know, turn the telly over. And he just went with the remote through it. And it went right on the corner, right into my head. And my head just went, next minute we're fighting and Alvin comes in. It was just a nightmare. He burnt me with an iron.
It sounds absolute carnage.
Oh.
And then he was getting on though. He was like.
We ended up being really, you know what I mean? I've done loads of events with Julian and all that. And it was, when we reminisce about, you know, the things that we did, the iron thing one, that was a big problem for me because he's ironing his shirt. I'm in the shower. So I come out, giving it all that like that. I said, leave the iron up there. And as I walked past him, he's got the iron and just gone. Bang, right on my ass. I had a V like that. The skin
oh, stuck on the
was
iron.
On his, stuck on the iron. So I'm screaming, gone to the window, like, and I'm going, ah! And he's looking at me like that. So I've gone to get him then, haven't I? Then he's going like this. It hasn't come near it. I'm thinking, I'm going to get a V here.
Home alone.
And I thought, he's going to do me again. All right, so just back off. But these are the
things. It was a bit of like a, I don't want to say power struggle, but you had two big players. Do you know what I mean? Was it like sort of, was it, would that have been a part of it?
I think we respected each other because Julian was a very, very good player. And I think when you look at his game, I played against him once and he was marking me for, I was playing for Everton, he was playing for Liverpool. And I said to him in the tunnel, I said, I'm going to destroy you today because it was my derby, you know, it meant a lot to me to play in a derby. And I scored, Cotty scored and we beat Liverpool. We battered them actually, but. I always say to him, it's the only time we ever played against each other in, you know, top level, like, and I said, I'd love to play against you every week. I said, and he says, that was a one-off. That was my debut. I was nervous, but he had a good game, actually. He nearly scored a screamer in the top corner, but, yeah, we ended up having to respect each other, and John's, like you said, his genius, really.
Yeah.
Because I think without rooming together and getting to know each other, and it's iron out all the things that we were, you know, we end up being really good mates.
Right, if we're going to talk about West Ham United in the 1990s, we can only really talk about one player, you've guessed it, the Italian maestro, Paolo Di Canio. He joined us on the pod and talked us through that goal against Wimbledon. You know the one, here he is. A few weeks after that Bradford game, the 5-4, you score the goal of the decade against Wimbledon.
Foe, stopped by Earl. Michael Hughes can't clear the first time, nor the second time. Bent wide nicely by Mark Vivian Foe. Sinclair's cross over Cunningham. Di Canio! I do not
believe that! That is sensational! Even by his standards.
Oh, take a bow, son. Take a bow. You are not going to see a better goal than this. Great ball from Foy. Even better ball from Sinclair. But that is just sensational. Outside of the right foot. He's off the ground with both feet when he makes contact. Look at him. Up he goes. Oh, that is quite sensational. What a magnificent goal.
a moment of striking perfection from Paolo Di Canio.
Incredible goal. West Ham fans still talk about it. They'll never forget it.
Lucky.
When that ball came, me and Ginger were talking and saying, like, how did you know how to do that? Because no one has ever scored a goal like that before or since. What could you see it in your head? Have you done that before in training?
Yeah, we used to practice with Joe Cole, Trevor Sinclair. Good delivery. I scored because he gave a very good pass.
That's what Trevor says as well. So always, when he
sent me a message, you scored this goal because of course, if you don't deliver the ball, I can't score. But anyway, we used to practice 2-3 days per week, maybe in 5-6. 10 minutes, 15 minutes at the end. I try who scored the best spectacular goal. Maybe try to flick the ball from behind, something like that, strange. I used to practice this bicycle, you know, dancing ballet, you know, in the air. I have a good timing, a good style, a good impact on the ball, but normally from vertical, not from diagonal delivery. It's obvious that this is remain to your brain, in my opinion, and maybe you can use once in 10 years. But I remember there was Kennedy. Kennedy was the Wimbledon right back skipper, if I'm not wrong. He was in front of me. The delivery was from the other side, from Sinclair to the far post where I was. I had 1, 2, 3 seconds. 1, 2. I saw Kennedy that was unsure if jump or maybe turn his body, try to challenge me, because normally with this ball you can cushion the ball and try to go 1v1. You know, you have time and space, try to beat him and try to shoot on the goal. Or more easy, in this position, you know, a striker or maybe attacking footballer use his nearly foot from when the ball come in the ground to cover with the other leg, even if it's not your proper foot, the left foot. Because if you have a bad impact on the ball can go in the box. Mm. Maybe your teammates can take advantage on it. I don't know. I like crazy things. Maybe something remain in my brain. In an instant, I decide to jump, in the air, and then have this movement, which I call bicycle movement. I think I have to tell you. I don't want to sound arrogant, but every time I'm watching this goal, but in Italy they show every 2-3 weeks from English. Highlights or Sky Sport UK, they send down to Italy the best goals in Premier League era, 10, maybe 10, 20. They always they show this goal. I think, forget it. This is Di Canio. This is a goal. This is difficult. It's difficult, because
I think. All as players, you try stuff in training, maybe overhead kicks or something. But to do it in a game, a Premier League game, like there's only probably only Paolo and you can name five who would try it in a game. And to do, I remember being a kid watching it and thinking, that is unreal why you've done that. And like to think, we were talking before we started the podcast about players like you, the real, real talented players, the decision making in your guy's head is instant, eh? Just don't even think about it, natural.
Yeah, I agree. You can see, if instinct is difficult to explain, but probably when you have something inside, you can elaborate in a so short instant that is not for everyone, only in this occasion, because I was an incredible footballer. But doing it, you must have something different inside, because you take also a risk, because if you go in the air with a side part of your right foot, normally you can have a bad touch on the ball, can remain there, maybe can go out from the end of the line
in the parking road
10 yards 20 yards, in a parking room road, but if you want to do something special, maybe you should have something special even for an instant inside you.
All right, West Ham fans, one way you can support Ironcast and help us rocket up the charts and beat off the competition from other official football clubs podcasts like Chelsea and like Spurs is to get a 5-star rating or review from you. Support me and Ginger on the podcast, chuck us a 5-star rating review, and help us rocket up the charts where West Ham belong, at the top of the table. Back on with the show. Right, Ginger's been dusting off his contact book throughout the year to bring in some of his old teammates, and one of those was former winger Matt Jarvis. He joined us to recount signing for the club and playing under Big Sam. When he signed you, I thought he must have looked at your stats and gone, yeah, Matt will get the most, yeah, crosses in. Did he do something like that with you?
Well, I'm glad you teed that up for me. I'd put in the most crosses in Europe and most successful crosses in Europe the season I was at Wolves and the first season at West Ham. Wow. So that is where...
The perfect Big Sam signing.
And yeah, when I signed, the first time I met Sam actually was when I come to the training ground after I'd signed, and he was in the port cabin with a meeting, and Tim's coming and goes, called Sam and said, Matt C's just signed. And I went to the port cabin bit and he's opened the door. He's doing a mini. He opened the door and he had to duck to get out. And I was like, oh my God. I'd never met him before. Like, he's massive. Yeah. And then he was like, is it done? And I was like, yeah, yeah, it's done. Like, good. You shake your hand. He went straight back in. And that was it.
Good.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
How did you find... Known you a long time, but never really asked you. How did you find it playing for Sam though? Because there's no doubt about it. We probably did go a little bit longer, if you like, than most teams sometimes. But you obviously tricky, wanted to get the ball down, beat players and cross it. Did you find it hard at all? Or did you think you was getting enough of the ball or seeing enough of the ball?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because yeah, games are very, very tricky, because sometimes, as you know, it stays more on the right, it stays more on the left. It's hard. As a wide player, you only get the ball when other people give you it. So yeah, it's quite hard. Although you say, you go and get the ball, it's very hard, because if you go and get the ball, then you're not out in your position when a team needs you to be out there. So it is tricky, but you have to adapt. And he was very... I learned a lot in the sense that where I had to be on the pitch with him, you're saying about goal kicks and set plays. Mm. I had to adapt to when the ball went up, a goal kick to Andy or Coley.
He was going in behind.
I had to pin the fullback, yeah, or the centre half behind. And I wasn't naturally, that wasn't my game, but I had to adapt to do that because I was getting to get hammered if I wasn't there. But also, like, that was where the ball was going to drop. And Kev used to be brilliant at it, because Andy used to flick it on, yeah, or Kev would just hold it up, yeah, and then you can come on to the front. And so that there's certain areas that you have to, you know, progress, and you have to observe, and you have to get better at. But as far as he wanted the ball to go wide and put crosses in, so it was a bit of give, yeah, and take, I suppose. Mm.
Sam had it was a lot of criticism from West Ham fans, and of course Big Sam Cup in his ear to the fans and that, and around the style of play, that was the criticism, and that it was, you know, anti-football, etc. I wondered, how did you feel some of that criticism was justified as players? A lot of years have passed now. Did you feel at the time, did you think, I wish we were playing a different way? Or,
I mean, I think every team would love to be Barcelona and play tiki-taka football, yeah, but it's not the case. You can't. Like, we had a great squad of players that, for instance, you know, you go from it was Yussi in goal, mm, majority of the time, then it was Adrian. But great keepers. Then you play it out and you had Ginger and Reedy at the back, big, physical, strong defenders that could zing a ball.
Yeah.
You then had your fullbacks that would get forward. You had your wild players that want to put cross you, and you had Andy up top or Coley, big target man with Kev just floating in and about. You know, that, why would you not go that sort of style? It worked for the, yeah, team, but obviously you'd want to be playing, nipping it around a corner, coming inside, doing all these things.
I think with Sam, like, obviously a lot of time's passing, a bit older, I think he would generally do, he would do anything it takes to win a game of football.
Yeah.
He wasn't bothered about if we had seven, like you see Brighton now, 700-800 passes. He wasn't bothered on that. And we weren't as players. He was mad stat, like, he was unreal with his stats. He knew everything stat-wise. So he would just do anything it took to win a game, to get 3 points.
That's all he cared about.
And that's all he cared, yeah, about. He didn't care. He not spoke to him since, but he wouldn't have been caring that the fans weren't liking it. He was concentrating, yeah, on getting 3 points. And whatever it took to get 3 points, he would do it.
Yeah.
Whether we played against a team that he thought we might have to pass a little bit more, because he wasn't anti it.
No.
He just thought our best chance of winning a game against so-and-so, whoever we're playing, is doing this type of football.
Yeah.
And you can't knock him for that.
No. Well, also, with regard to his plan, you could see what it was. He signed you, the best crosser at the time, and big Andy Carroll.
He said, honestly, he said
hello.
To him, he
said, there's some days in training I'd look over to Jarvo and I'd feel sorry for him, I think. Every time Jarvo got up, Andy, with you with
hang
your crosses.
Hang it.
Jarvo used to like to whip it, like, you know, the David Beckham, like, bit of bend on the cross, like across the 6 yard line. Andy just used to like hit drill to the back stick so he could come on.
Just hang it up.
Every time, Jarvo, just cross the ball. Don't chop back, cross the ball.
This is Andy. This ain't even Sam. Well, Dean Ashton was another of Ginger's former teammates to share his story on Ironcast this season. He revealed all on the agonising decision to retire from football at the age of 26 due to an ankle injury. Here's our former number 9, Dino.
I definitely had a period where I thought, oh, it feels better. Like, it genuinely feels like I could be getting back. And then I did get back and was out and run on the grass and done everything I should do, ready to leading up to try and train. Maybe not 100%, but I thought I've done enough running to want to join in with the and it's like a bonus as well. It's like to be able to go out with the players and start a training session. And then we just normally have a jog around the pitch on the before we then actually start the proper warm-up where the lads will have a chat. And just even running round, I could hear this clicking noise. And I know Kieran Dyer was like, is that your new boots? I was like, no, that's my ankle.
I remember that conversation about we thought you had put your boots on, new boots, and they were rubbing and it was Dino's ankle session.
It was just clicking. And then I couldn't start the warm up, and then that was when I knew that this was the end. And I got quite upset. But Scott Parker came over and went, Dino, not here. Come on.
I should remember.
Why does Scott Parker say not here? It doesn't.
I think
he was trying to protect me.
Captain,
and I don't know if the session was being filmed or what. Yeah. But I think he just sort of. But at that point, you just know that it's not probably going to be.
Do you remember the afternoon after that, the days after that? Did you think that you knew that was it?
Well, I think that the days after that is, I know I've got to have another operation straight away. If I'm going to carry on, it's going to be another operation, back to square one, back to the starting point again, which is just, once you know it's going to happen again, that is the dread of the rehab. So it was with the retirement side of it. In the end, it was such a relief to retire. I can't imagine that.
Because
when you're 25 years old and you can't get up in the morning and just walk downstairs, it takes you 20 minutes to get from your bed downstairs because you've got to let the ankle kind of loosen to a point where you can walk properly down the stairs. And you can't go to the shops with your family. You have to sit down after 10 minutes and let them carry on, and then they come back to you, and then you can do another 10 minutes. And you think, I'm 25 years old and I can't do the simple things as your kids are starting to grow up. How am I going to then go in the garden and play?
Rest of your life,
What am I going to do for the rest of my life? I can't do these small things. It became a relief to think, finally, I don't have to have another.
Did you make the decision, Dino? Did you call it a day, or were you advised?
No, I'd have tried to go through it again and had the operation again. But a surgeon in Holland was like, if you want a reasonable life going forward for the rest of your life to be able to walk properly and have some time with your kids, he said, now is probably the time you have to make that decision. And that was probably the best thing, that someone gave you that real reality check of what was going to happen if you thought you could carry on.
Yeah, it's a mad to say. I was thinking earlier, there's not many players of your generation who went through something like that. I can't think of many players who were a bigger name as you that had to retire young. You're probably the only one I can really think of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there is a few that had that potential and had it sort of snatched away, but it was obviously very difficult. I'm just very, very unfortunate that it happened to be me and at that time. But then again, I've got to look at how fortunate I was that I actually got to do it and
scored an FA Cup final.
Exactly, and got to experience the things I did because I started young.
Did you struggle after it, Dino? A bit of a personal question. How was it after that, you know, the next year, year and a half, 2 years? Ooh, yeah. Was it
mind-numbingly difficult?
Yeah, I can imagine.
Just where do you start? I mean, where do I start in terms of how hard it is? It's sort of, I mean, you know how hard it is anyway, the sacrifice you have to make to be a player. But again, what maybe people forget is it's our dream. Like, this is, it's not a job. It's, this is just, how is this our life that we get to just have our dream to play in front of this amount of people every week, with the support that you get, the accolades that come with it, the lifestyle. It's everything you dream about. And when you just get there and then it's taken away, it's really, really difficult to handle. And I think because of the injury side of it and the pain I was in at the time, that was the relief. But I think there's lots of things that maybe people don't maybe realize is when you retire is, I felt really guilty. I felt really guilty for other people. So I felt really guilty for my family that I wasn't going to be able to continue and maybe give them the life that I thought I was going to do. I felt really guilty for my grandparents who came every weekend or every away game. That was their weekend that they would come and watch me, and I couldn't give them that anymore. That was finished for them. And things like when you financially obviously doing well, you look after your family. So you might retire your parents. You might buy a property for someone within your family. And all of a sudden you're having to change those things. I think people don't maybe, and you earn great money. So, you have that, of course. But I just felt really guilty for all these people.
Wow.
Even though it was me who was having to go through it, ultimately, I felt quite guilty. I felt quite guilty for the supporters, for the club that had paid big money for me and I couldn't repay that, for the supporters that wanted to see me and I couldn't then fulfill that. So I had quite a bit of guilt. And then you have the bitterness of, and I think it's normal, absolutely normal to be bitter. Why is it me? Why has that player got to have a full career? Why is it me that's missing out? And I think they're all normal feelings to have, but they're feelings you have to deal with. And only over time do you kind of get over that. But I'm really, really good at keeping a check with reality, in that, you know, football is a fantasy. It's not real. It's just not real. The whole lifestyle is just obscenely great. And it's just not real. Real life is with your family, the things that you can enjoy at home, holidays. Though that's the actual reality. Football is just a fantasy. And I've tried to always keep the two separate.
Now, we can't end this without looking back at one of my favourite episodes from the first series of Ironcast with current first teamer Angelo Ogbonna. What a man. What a unique laugh he has that I did not see coming. Anyway, he shared his memories on that final day at the bowling ground. Take it away, Ange. Your name is forever etched in West Ham history because you play the last game at Upton Park. I just wanted to ask you, like, what was it like before the game? What was the emotion you felt?
I think even if I wanted to dream something like that, I couldn't, because the atmosphere is, we the game being delayed, and then all the fans were carrying the bus to.
It was mental, wasn't it?
Mental, amazing. I remember I had some friends over. And they say, oh, I want to come to the stadium because I know the stadium in England is more secure than Italy. So everything is more quiet when you go to the stadium. To the stadium, it's like you go to theater. I said, are you sure?
It was mayhem.
You don't know West Ham fans. I said, no, it's going to be like that. So they were driving in. And they saw all the noise, all the things. And one of my friends, please, they were begging my missus to walk with them. I said, what are you doing? And my missus said, what are you doing? No, it's not safe. No, it's unbelievable. I want to join them. And so after the game, we won the game. They came to me and said, okay, we didn't see your goal. We didn't care. But what I care before the game, when everyone was supporting the team. This is our home, you know. You can't come here and win, you know what I mean? And
Brilliant.
You know, but it's something like really, stay with me.
I think, I remember being on the bus, you remember being on the bus going in? It was just mental. And then obviously, like Angelo says, the game got put back. I think it didn't kick off till about 8:30 or something that night.
I remember they ran out of Man United.
Shocks you remember that. don't remember nothing about the game, but I remember they ran out of beer before the game. I think in a way, because it was so mental, I didn't really think of the magnitude of it. We obviously knew it was a massive night. It was the last game there, but I think it was that mad. I had never seen it. I'd been here before you and played in big games and that, but I had never seen anything like that.
What was said before the game, before you line up in the tunnel to come out? Do you remember the final words? Did Slav say anything? Did Nob say anything? Is it a blur?
It's just excitement by then. Yeah, like you want to get out there.
Excited. Yeah. But even during the game, we had the feeling like...
You could tell, couldn't you? I feel like, I'm glad you said that. I feel like I was on the bench, but I feel like you could tell we were going to win the game.
Yeah.
It was just... inevitable, wasn't it?
Something
was going to happen. We were getting, and obviously Winston pops up and gets the winner. But that night, there was just something in the air that you could tell it was gonna end.
Oh, amazing!
Yeah, best atmosphere you've ever played in.
I think so. Gotta be. But now we play in London Stadium. Okay, it's our home. Okay, yeah, we did something to let everyone like come together, you know. But Bowling Ground, mate. Wow.
I love it.
But the feeling was.
I think that last game, say when I'm older.
Last game, man.
Like with my kids or my grandkids. I think if they asked me about a lasting memory of West Ham when I was a player, I think. For two reasons, obviously emotional, obviously because it was, you know, to see what it meant to people and see the fans crying and the old boys, you know, all at the stadium. And I think it'd probably be the game that I'll talk about. Say my grandson asked me in years to come, what's the one game you remember? It will be that last game
for the result.
and just seeing people in the, you know, full grown men in tears and ripping seats out and that. It was just, it'd probably be my lasting memory when I'm a lot older.
All right, well, what a year it's been for Ironcast. Brilliant guests, brilliant stories. Remember, we've got loads of other super episodes which you can go back and listen to. Don't forget, there's Dave Martin, Bobby Zamora, Tony Gale, Anton Ferdinand, Kevin Keane, and many more. I genuinely can't wait for 2024. From myself, Ginge, and everyone at West Ham United, we would like to wish you all a happy and healthy new year. And until next time, come on, you Irons.
Podcast Network.